how to defend it.
Oh, no.
I can't say it now.
Robert Gopet?
I sent her a thing. It said, what did it say? How did I put it? Are we having an old-fashioned meeting?
An old-fashioned place with some old-fashioned people. Sorry. And I wasn't on my game.
Tammy said, and she'll finish it with some old-fashioned
right
prayer.
Order.
And you did.
What's the wrong order?
Words to that song?
Oh, I don't know.
I was checking you.
I like that song.
All right, who knows who Robert Grossetest was?
He wrote the letter of expostulation and refusal denouncing papal finance.
All right, it's going to be on the quiz.
I'm dropping out right now.
I'm going to get that ice cream.
I can't say expostulation, is that right?
The reason why is because something was different in England. Remember we talked about all the different events that had happened and you had all these, the Roman Empire and what have you. The Roman Empire reached all the way to Great Britain and they took over Great Britain. They didn't get as far as Ireland. They didn't necessarily take over all of Scotland, but they did have a presence in England, and they were forced out around the year 400 because of the Goths and the fall of the Roman Empire. So, but from then on, you had the Celtic Rite, the English Rite. It was a little different than the Romish Rite, and the Roman Church grew into what we now know of as the Catholic Church in the continent. And there was all kinds of interplay on the continent. But for some reason why, England and Ireland were, well, we know why, the English Channel. It's an island. They call it insular because that's Latin for island. Insular, they had the insular art. They had the insular rite. They had all the, it was an insular island in the sense that there was less back and forth. And one of the things that came out, because it was had an insular attitude, meaning they were thinking of themselves as an entity in themselves, not necessarily part of the mainland, part of Europe. They knew they were part, and they did have interaction, but they still had, I mean, we're talking about a great number of Britons, of the British, they had this insular attitude where they wanted to take care of their own. And I don't know if you realize it, but this is basically the same attitude that the Americans had when they were being taxed. But the tax money that they were being taxed wasn't turned around and put right back into their own economy in, you know, infrastructure or whatever. It was being sent over to England to fight England's wars in Australia or wherever else, you know. And that's why the American colonists had a real reaction against it, you know, and they had the Tea Party and all that stuff because they were fighting against these taxes that weren't going to them. Well, this happened a long time before that in England. And what happened was people in England resented the fact that money that was given to the church, a lot of money that was given to the church, would disappear from England and go. And during the Crusades, I forget which pope it was, he decides that they're going on a crusade. He decides, he makes a law, what they called back then, I forget what it was, a benefice or something like that, that he makes this law that they have to give money. They have to give 10% of the church's income to the pope for this crusade. And this got some of the English very angry. And this guy, Robert Grossetest, he was one of what they call the School of Oxford. The School of Oxford included Roger Bacon and William of Ockham, the guy known for the scientific principle, Ockham's razor. These are very famous, basically the beginning of modern science in Oxford over there in England. And this is one of the guys there. They call him the School of Oxford. And he was an archbishop, or he was some big shot in the Catholic Church. And he writes a letter. He writes this thing saying, we're not accepting that. He actually goes to Rome and tells the Pope himself, and really laid it down on the line, gave the Pope trouble. Anyway, that's the earliest I can find this premonition of what we call the English Reformation. Just to let you know, there was reform movements all over the Roman Empire. There were reform movements in Italy. There were reform movements in of course, in Germany, obviously, in Bohemia and Bavaria and in Brussels and in Switzerland and France. They all of them had the reformers. They were all Catholics. Nobody was thinking about dividing the Catholic Church. That wasn't ever part of the reform movement. The reform movement was, we've got to get the church to correct its bad practices. And of course, the bad practices had to do with being a monopoly and having power. They had power to tax, and they had all kinds of money, and they had nobody to police them. They had nothing. Everything they did was secret. They did not have their councils out and open. Nobody knew what went on. Nobody knew what was talked about. Everything was secret. It's all dangerous, dangerous stuff. And so there was all kinds of reforms being passed around. But everybody can look at the English Reformation and see there's something different in the English Reformation. And of course, I trace it back to their insular attitude. The English Reformation got its start because it was resentful of Rome for sending money to Rome. Same thing happened in Mexico in the 19th century, like the 1800s and early 1900s. The same thing happened in Mexico. They got very frustrated with all the riches of Mexico being sent to Spain. And they have laws. Today, to this day, they have laws in Mexico that a foreigner cannot be a priest. He cannot be a minister of religion. It's written right into their constitution. That was one of the reasons why we, as foreign ministers, were not allowed to baptize or to be actual pastors of a congregation. Which was fine, because in our way of thinking, we weren't pastors of the congregation. We were missionaries. All we did was preach the gospel. And everything, the money was all done through them. We didn't gather the money. We didn't count it. We didn't decide what it was going to go to. It was all their money. It was completely indigenous from the start. But one of the reasons why it was necessary to do it that way is because of their constitutional requirement. Foreigners are not allowed to do any public ceremony as Christians, so we weren't even allowed to baptize. Now, we broke that law on a number of occasions when there was nobody else to baptize, because God's law comes first. But when it was possible to obey their law, we did. We let them baptize. They did the baptizing because of that law. And this is an insular attitude. This is an attitude of, why are we sending our money overseas and we don't see any of it? This happened, and this is the first instance that I find of it. I'm sure it happened before this, but English history gets kind of dark back in, you know, the Middle Ages. It gets really hard to find. Less and less is available. But that's one of the earliest ones I can find. And you can search him out, and you can find out his argument with Rome that he had over that. Then you keep on going down. You have the different statutes of provisors, which was another, basically the same thing. English law making a fight against Roman law. English law making exceptions and saying, we are not going to allow the Roman church to make these decisions on our island. And this kept on building. This kept on building, as well as the principles of democracy were building, like in the Magna Carta. You've heard of that. That was back in 1215, even before these evidences of anti-Rome sentiment. But there was a lot of anti-Rome sentiment in the 1200s and probably even before that. And you see all these statutes that were being passed. This was all anti-Roman because of this island mentality. That, look, we are our own state. If we're going to have a church here, it ought to be our church. Now, later on during the English Reformation, we had very important people of the Reformation, like John Knox. They made the argument that it's because there was always an English church that was separate from Rome. They called it the English Rite or the Celtic Rite Church. And these were Protestants trying to prove that they didn't really descend from Rome, and that what they were doing was reestablishing the national church. I don't think that that's really true. I think there's probably some truth to it, but I don't think it's really accurate, because they were connected to Rome, obviously, all those years. And you had a lot of them defending the Pope. Even this guy, Grosseteste, he defended the Pope. He was arguing against the Pope on some of his, and the Pope agreed with him and changed the rules and actually made rules to favor the English attitude, because the English were upset about this. This was an island-wide thing. This was a nationwide thing. People did not like the Church of Rome taking money out. So you can see already there's a building resentment against Rome over the issue of Rome taking English treasure out to use it somewhere else. During this attitude, you have a guy named Wycliffe. Nobody really knows where Wycliffe got his... He was in Oxford. And so he got some of his ideas from the School of Oxford. And we know he was taught by this Grosseteste and by Roger Bacon. And he had them. That was part of it. And so he learned something of that. But it looks in a lot of ways like Wycliffe innovated. Like Wycliffe got his own vision, his own revelation of what the Bible is. He fell in love with the scriptures. He just really liked the Bible. And a lot of people back in those days did. A lot of English people were very focused on the Bible over there in Oxford. And Roger Bacon, they had treatises on the Bible. They were very big Bible students. So Wycliffe was really strong on the Bible, and something happened. I didn't put it into this, but right around 1370-something, 72 or 75, something like that, Wycliffe is made a teacher of pupils in Oxford, a Bible teacher of pupils in Oxford, and some Roman pontiff or whatever gets over there and changes the rules on him and says that Rome, and through Rome the Archbishop and the Cardinal, get to appoint whoever they want as you know, in these positions in Oxford. And so it was, and so this guy, he's a Roman guy, he comes over and he says, I'm going to appoint, and he appointed one of his friends. And so Wycliffe says, well, this is not fair. I've been teaching this. I was appointed this by the king. This is my position. So they had this lawsuit, this fight. And he went to Rome to defend himself, and he lost. The Pope sided with his Roman, you know, his guy. So from then on, you see Wycliffe has changed. He's no longer pro-Rome. It looks like that fight that he had, this legal fight that he had with Rome, changed his attitude. And then you find him writing this thing called the Civili Dominio, which is transformative because it's saying the church should not have civil power at all. Mm-hmm. And of course, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. What is the church doing with civil power? We know that the church got its civil power by misunderstanding the millennial reign. We know that that's where it comes from. They start thinking we have to make the world into, we'll conquer the world, that's what our job is. And of course, that's not at all what Jesus said. He said we're trying to give them eternal life. And when the millennial reign comes, it's going to really come just like it said. And so we understand the Bible differently than they did. But they had this idea, and somehow Wycliffe got the clue, got the idea. There is no reason for the church to have civil power. And he writes this. This is one of the early ones. He writes this, the Civili Dominio. And that's that the church should renounce all civil power and stop interfering with the civil law. And basically that's saying our kings and our noblemen, they're the ones that make our decisions in the civil realm. Like who's going to be the teacher in Oxford or whatever. So this changes some things. And of course, then Wycliffe, he with a whole bunch of others of his followers, translate the Wycliffe Bible, the first complete Bible in English, translated from the Latin Vulgate. Still, it was also transformative. Still had more statutes coming out. You had the Lollards, which were followers of Wycliffe, or Wycliffe joined the Lollards, and they existed before Wycliffe. We're not real sure where the Lollards come from. They wrote the 12 conclusions of the Lollards, which, listen, this is a Reformation document. If you read it, you can look it up on Wikipedia or anywhere online, the 12 conclusions of the Lollards, and read what they had to say. This is a Reformation document long before Martin Luther. They're saying, you know, they're against confession to a priest, they're against images, they just write down the line, this is a Reformation document. If you read it, you realize the Reformation was going on a long time before Martin Luther. It was already happening. And of course, these people were there was one very famous Lollard that was a nobleman, and he joined some plot to overthrow something, the king or some, I don't know what it was, and he got defeated. And it was known that he was a Lollard. And when that happened, they clamped down on the Lollards. They just attacked them everywhere and wiped them out, burned them, killed them, did everything they could. That really persecuted them. That hurt the Lollards pretty bad and their reputation. You were asking something?
Yeah, I want to go back to the writing.
Okay.
First complete English Bible. Was that the Old and the New Testament? Mm-hmm. So that's when they had a complete... And this was translated from where?
From the Latin Vulgate.
And what was the Latin Vulgate?
All right. Remember I told you that the Bible was translated into Latin. Vulgate means the common Bible. Vulgate means common. Like vulgar, it means common. It doesn't mean ugly or profane. It means common. Actually, the word profane means common. So, to understand the etymology of it, the Vulgate simply means this is the common Bible. In English, our King James Version would be considered the Vulgate. It's the common edition. Okay. And in fact, it's many times called the common edition, or our common version, or our common Bible. That's what it means, common. The Latin Vulgate was the common Latin Bible. Now, the Latin Vulgate was not controlled by any group to say who could print what and whatever. So anybody would get the Latin Vulgate and print it with their own changes. And this happened over and over and over again, so that the Latin Vulgate was in a bad shape by the time of the European Reformation. But when we talk about the Latin Vulgate, we're talking about the common edition of the Latin Bible. And there's certain things that you know about the Latin Vulgate. You had the Greek Vulgate in Greek, and it was almost 100% uniform. Remember, the Greek Vulgate, they had such a meticulous way of copying it and making it right, that by the time it became the only Bible quoted by the year 400 on. Before the year 400, there's lots of different quotations among the fathers. After the year 400, the Greek Vulgate is what is quoted. It's the only Bible there is after the year 400. And by the time they started the fall of Constantinople, and they got all these Greek manuscripts over there into the West, and they started comparing them to the Latin Vulgate, and there was an outcry. They wanted a uniform standard Bible that corrected the Latin Vulgate and made them all the same, and so that the whole Christendom would have just one Bible. This was called the Textus Receptus, or the formation of the Textus Receptus. What happens is Erasmus starts printing one, collating one, getting some manuscripts and collating one and getting ready to print one, and Cardinal Jimenez in Spain also is doing it, and they're rushing to try to be the first. And of course, Erasmus was first. He got his out in 1516, and Cardinal Jimenez got his out in 1519. And then, of course, 1519, Erasmus puts out a second one, and then 1522, a third one, and Jimenez his second one in 1522. So they were just competing and going, but they had different manuscripts on different sides of the world. Basically, Erasmus was in London, and Cardinal Jimenez was in Spain, and completely different manuscripts, and yet those two editions of the Greek Bible are almost identical. Not enough difference. The only difference that was notable at the time was, and there might have been other minor differences, but the notable difference at the time was 1 John 5:7. The copy of the Greek Vulgate that Erasmus had didn't have 1 John 5:7, so his first editions didn't have it. And Jimenez had 1 John 5:7 in it and said that his Greek copies had it. Turns out that Jimenez, after they printed them, took those manuscripts, didn't think they were valuable, and since all paper was very valuable back in those days, believe it or not, to make firecrackers, that they were making fireworks. That was a big deal in Spain. They made fireworks. Well, they would soak up paper from everywhere, get paper from anything. So paper had a certain value as secondhand. So when they printed, Cardinal Jimenez printed his deal, he took all his manuscripts and sold them to the firecrackers, and they all got burned up. Even though these were some of the few documents of the Greek Vulgate that we had that had 1 John 5:7 in it. The Greek Vulgate didn't normally have it. But according to Cardinal Jimenez, his did have it. And so because of that, Erasmus decided to put his in it, because his New Testament started selling less because it didn't have it. And so he said, okay. And he put it in it because there was such a demand for it. So then they were uniform. They were the same.
Was the Apocrypha in there?
Yeah. All the Bibles back in those days had the Apocrypha. In fact, our King James Bible had the Apocrypha until 1769. In fact, you can buy the King James Bible with the Apocrypha today. The actual Apocrypha translated by King James. The Apocrypha was known among Protestants as good extra reading. But it was mentioned right in there, between the Testaments. It was mentioned right in there, this is not canonical. It's not scripture. It's just, it's a filler in between the Testaments to let you know what happens between the two Testaments. And it stopped being printed with the Bible by most Protestants by the year 1769. But yeah, it had the Apocrypha. And it was, these were Catholics. Martin Luther was a Catholic. Savonarola was a Catholic. Wycliffe was a Catholic. These people did not have the idea of breaking away from the church or starting a Protestant church or anything like that. They believed in the one Holy Roman Catholic Church. They believed in it. All of them did. And yet there were so many factions within the Catholic Church. Not only were there orders, like the Franciscans had a horrible fight against the Jesuits, and I know this by I've learned this first off by the fight that they had in Mexico over the Virgin of Guadalupe, because I did some research on the Virgin of Guadalupe, found out where it came from. The Franciscans hated what the Jesuits did with that, and the Jesuits had their way of conquering. Franciscans were by far a better group of people. And then, of course, you had the Benedictines, and you had the Augustines, and you had all these different orders, and then you had all the different friars, the different monks, and you had the different fraternities, and all the different regional separations, the different rites, we'd say, the Celtic rite, and you had the northern rites, and every region had a little different Catholicism. But they all realized it's just one big church, and most of them accepted the Pope as the de facto leader of the whole. He's the Bishop of Rome. The city of Rome was the de facto leadership city. So, that wasn't an issue. Never was that an issue. Not with Wycliffe, not with any of these others. They wanted the church reformed. They wanted the Pope to change the laws on, say, how bishops were appointed. They wanted the Pope. They would read the scriptures and say, why are bishops celibate? In fact, in England, their bishops weren't celibate. I'm trying to think of several of them that were Catholic bishops, but had wives and children.
That's right now in England. I think I just read something.
Yes, now England does it again, but that was
allowing them to marry.
But back in those days, before the Reformation, back in Wycliffe's days and all that, these men, it was Wolsey. Wolsey was the Catholic bishop that refused to annul King Henry VIII's marriage, and he was a Catholic in good standing, but he had a wife and 12 children or something like that. So it was never, the Catholic Church was not one top-down, you know, one only doctrine. There was a lot of differences. And so the calls for reform had to do with, some of them wanted to get back to Scripture. Some of them wanted to just stop the simony. Simony is where they would accept money to give you a position in the church. So you come up and say, look, I've got $100,000 I'll give you if you give me this prebend or this position. And so you become the curate of such and such a whatever, you know. And of course, then you get your money back as you charge people. It's called simony. They wanted to stop the simony. And that comes from Simon the sorcerer in Acts chapter 8, where he tried to buy the Holy Spirit. They had all of these issues. And Wycliffe came out. Listen, Wycliffe was a Protestant. This guy's a Protestant 150, 200 years before Protestantism, before Martin Luther. And you read the Lollards, you read all of this. This was a real crackdown against a Reformation, but it didn't work. In other words, they tried to kill off all these Lollards, and all what happened was they just shut up. They went underground. And so a lot of people think that this underground church that existed at least since Wycliffe, some people think even before Wycliffe, and of course you've got undercurrents of anti-Rome sentiment clearly stated before this. You can find it. So maybe it did exist before him. But for sure there was an underground church, underground movement against Rome 200 years before Martin Luther in England. Now, that itself makes it special. England's Reformation was special. In fact, we might say that all the Reformation happened because of what happened with Wycliffe and the Lollards 200 years before it. John Huss some of the Lollards went over into Holland and over into Germany and began teaching. And they got connected with some of the Waldensians. In fact, one of the Waldensians over there in Bavaria moved to England because of these connections. And so the Waldensians, which were Anabaptists, they would rebaptize their converts, and they were not Roman. They did not believe in Rome, whatever. They had connections. We know they had connections. Some people think that's how the Lollards got their name. There's evidences that they already had that name before him. So who knows? It's hard to tell. But one way or the other, the Lollards, when they were persecuted, they went over to the mainland, and John Huss of Bavaria, 100 years before Martin Luther, was taught this Lollard doctrine, this Wycliffeite doctrine, and was teaching that in Bavaria, which is now Czechoslovakia. Actually, it's not even Czechoslovakia anymore, it's the Czech Republic. He was teaching that until finally the Pope said, you have to desist. And he said, well, I can defend it. And he tried to defend himself. They gave him safe conduct, and then they burned him at the stake. They broke their word. They didn't let him go back. So he was burned at the stake 100 years before Martin Luther. Well, he was a disciple of Wycliffe, of the Lollards. So it's possible to see that the Reformation, how it happened, was a direct result of what God did in England 200 years before the Reformation happened in the mainland. All right, some important things. For example, Erasmus's first edition. I kind of like explained a little bit about it. Erasmus, there was a worldwide or Christendom-wide complete universal agreement that the Greek Vulgate and the Latin Vulgate needed to be standardized together. And so, obviously, the ones that the Latin, people who spoke Latin, didn't want their Bible changed, but they also wanted the information that was in the Greek Bible. And there were some differences. There were some things omitted from the Greek Bible that the Latin Bible had, and there were some things omitted in the Latin Bible that the Greek Bible had. And so they wanted it standardized, and so this is why there was such a demand for this. And so these things got standardized. By the year 1522, we had a Textus Receptus. We had a basic, standardized, unified Bible worldwide. It's called the Textus Receptus. A lot of people nowadays criticize the Textus Receptus as if it was just Erasmus's, late, sloppy attempt to get something printed and, sell some books, whatever. And that's not it at all. There was a tremendous demand for this, and he was not the only one doing it. The only reason why he rushed his first edition, and his other editions were not rushed. They were well thought out and well corrected and well researched and what have you. So it's a false accusation against the Textus Receptus. And they think that it's an idea that all they did was take a few late manuscripts and put them together, and they did a sloppy job of it. That's also not what happened. They took the best manuscripts they were, and they were so uniform, completely uniform, that several different groups in different parts of the continent came up with the same exact Bible. And by 5 or 6 years, they had unified them. They had standardized them. They had argued it out together and come to the decisions. And they included the Latin text readings like 1 John 5:7 and Luke 17:36 and the ending of the Lord's Prayer, all these things. They had included all of these things by a decision, a consensus decision. This is what everybody wanted. So they added to the Greek Bible what was found in Latin, and they added to the Greek Bible, and they kept in the Greek Bible what was missing in the Latin, so that the Textus Receptus was a uniform consensus Bible, one of the few times that all of Christendom was in agreement. And this is everybody. Everybody was in agreement with this concept. Even Catholics, they were in agreement. Cardinal Jimenez was a Catholic, and Erasmus was a Reformer. So the traditionalists and the Reformers, they were in agreement. In fact, Luther didn't break from the Catholic Church till, 1526 or something like that, later. And they were all in agreement. So what you wind up having is all of these different editions forming the universal original text Bible, which nowadays they completely discount it as if it's very poor scholarship. took, it wasn't poor scholarship, it was excellent scholarship, and it's a defendable premise to this day. I personally believe that the Vulgates are accurate. If God says he gave us his word and this his word is what we're supposed to follow, how could we then say that the word of God, the true word of God, was lost for those 1,500 years when all we had was the Vulgates? That's the only way Bibles could be published, was by manuscript, and they did such a good job as manuscript publishing, and that's the only way the Bible existed. It had to be correct. The Vulgates have to be correct, or God didn't. God, we couldn't count on these Bibles. So in my mind, it's an obvious fact that these Vulgates were God's doing, and that the Textus Receptus, which was the standardization of the two main Vulgates, was God's doing. Okay. Tyndale's New Testament came out in 1526. Oh, in 1522, Erasmus's third edition, you'll see what it says there in the Complutensian Polyglot. They had the consensus on 1 John 5:7 and several other disagreements. By that time, we had a Textus Receptus. Then comes all the translations. By the next 25, 30, maybe 50 years, every major language in Europe had the Bible, the Textus Receptus, translated into their language.
I'm calling the Textus Receptus, that's the King James.
It's like the King James, yeah. The King James is from the Textus Receptus.
But it's just in the English that we understand versus trying to read it in those,
well,
those English.
Well, before the King James was in Tyndale's. You'll see in 1526, Tyndale's New Testament. Tyndale translated the New Testament and the Pentateuch all the way up to 2 Chronicles, and then he was killed, so he didn't finish it. And a fellow named John Rogers finished it and printed it as the Matthew's Bible in 1530s. Anyway, that was the first Textus Receptus complete Bible, the Matthew's Bible, and it was outlawed immediately. This is what's so amazing, and let me see if we're there yet. Oh yeah, 1521. After Martin Luther did it, King Henry VIII's going on, he writes against Luther. You got to see this when it comes to the English Reformation. Because the English Reformation did not happen like it did with Luther, where you had this monk who argues against the Pope, and then these kings and nobles and everybody take sides. So you had a bunch of German nobles that took the sides of the Pope, and then you had a bunch of German nobles that took the side of Martin Luther, and then they fought it out and wound up being divided in a simple split, a polarized split, two ways. You had Luther, and you had the Lutherans or the Reformers or the Protestants, and then you had the Papists. That's not what happened in England. Because what happened in England was King Henry VIII, already there was such an anti-Rome sentiment that it was not necessary to have a monk that was armed with, you know, 90% of the printing presses in the world that printed his stuff. It was an amazing thing. The printing press is what made Martin Luther successful, because he was right in Wittenberg, and Germany literally had 90%. By the 1500s, Germany had 90% of all the printing presses in the world, and they wanted stuff to print. That's how they made money. And they would sell this stuff all over Europe. All over Europe. It was a big money-making deal, and they had the monopoly on it. And here is Martin Luther right there in Wittenberg, starts writing things against the Pope and against these bishops and prelates and whatever. And these printing presses are taking this stuff and printing it out and getting it. He goes everywhere. And this just disseminated. And of course the Pope would write a bull and it wouldn't even get printed. They would take it, they would make handwritten copies of it and take it to certain main parish churches and nail it up on the door. And Martin Luther would write an answer, and 2 days later, he would have hundreds of thousands of copies all over Europe. He was the most powerful man anywhere because of his, this is God. See, this is what I'm trying to say. This is God doing. God did all this. So, something happened though in England that was different. In England, there already was an anti-Rome sentiment. And so when King Henry VIII needed his divorce, and of course, unbiblical, whatever, he didn't have a male heir. They had just gone through the 30 Years' War because of a succession war. And everybody knew he had to have an heir. So he marries this third cousin. She was actually his father or his elder brother's wife when he died, or when he was forced to resign or whatever. He he annulled the marriage because it was never consummated, and so they just gave that woman to King Henry VIII. And so you think, this is a messed up system. But, all right, they did this to try to keep the kingly line, whatever. He couldn't have a child. Her only son died at 6 days old or whatever, and then she could not get pregnant. So we're talking about 10, 15 years. He's getting old. He's saying, I've got to have a son or we're going to have a war. He's got all these women, and there's no line of succession with women. All these women are going to be fighting it out, and they have all these different nobles that are on each woman's side, whatever. This is going to be another 30 years war. So King Henry says, look, I need to annul this marriage. And so he comes up with his reasons. He sends them over to the Pope. And of course, everybody knows what the real reason is. He's got to have an heir. Well, the Pope says no, but it wasn't no because of, you know, doctrine that we can't allow, you know, that they did this all the time. They had just annulled it before that for his brother so he could marry Catherine and whatever. The reason why is Catherine of Aragon was the sister of King Philip. And King Philip in Spain. And if it gets divorced, then their treaty's done, and King Philip of Spain's going to attack. So, and no, King Philip of Spain sends and tells the Pope, don't you annul that. It's all political. It's all political. Anyway, Tyndale writes a book. There's only, if you take the top 10 important books in history, one of them ought to be, you think about it, one called The Obedience of a Christian Man by William Tyndale. One of his more obscure books. But here's the thing. One of Tyndale's students or pupils was the confessor of was it Catherine or was it, might have been Anne Boleyn. Well, it was one of these women. And she had it there, and when King, she had this book there, that The Obedience of a Christian Man, when that king was upset, went and was talking to this woman, that the book was right there, he picked it up and read it. And the thing about it is that William Tyndale had written, sort of like Wycliffe had written, that civil power should not be in the hands of Rome or in the hands of the priest, it should be in the hands of the king. And of course, here's the king, and he's reading this, and he fell in love with his book. This is King Henry VIII that fell in love with this book written by William Tyndale, who, 3 or 4 years later, he burns at the stake. You know, because he's a radical Protestant. Anyway, he reads this and he realizes, this is true. This is true. This is scriptural. And so, right after the Pope, Leo X, gives him a commendation for being a defender of the faith because he wrote against Martin Luther. Couldn't stand Luther. Thought Luther was a heretic. Had all his reasons. He had biblical reasons. He wrote a long treatise on why Luther was wrong. Well, just a few days later, he changes everything. He says the king should be the head of all this power, and the Rome should not have any of this civil power. And basically, so why is he waiting for these cardinals, everything, to grant him his divorce? Another thing was this Cardinal Wolsey, which was the intermediator between the Pope and him, who he was applying for the divorce from. Well, he kept on dragging his feet. He kept on whatever. Finally, they have him executed based on the premonitory, what's called the first statute of premonitory in 1350. No, the second statute, 1393. He was executed because he did not obey that statute. It's against papal translation, church precedents, prebends, whatever. The Pope, there was a law in England stating from way back before, an anti-Romish law that's stating that these men cannot take the Pope's, cannot take their pleas outside of England and make their arguments in a foreign court. They got to make them here. And he did this. This Wolsey, the guy that was supposed to be doing that, was making all his pleas in, or the Pope made the statement, you cannot, we're not going to have these arguments in trial in England anymore. They have to be made in Rome. And Wolsey agreed and went and made them in Rome. So the king said he broke this law and got rid of him. And then he writes the Act of Supremacy. And the Act of Supremacy is the king says we break with Rome. Now look, this is not a doctrinal issue. This is an anti-Rome issue in this insular Christianity of England, Reformist ideology in England, and the Protestant is not a Protestant in the sense of doctrine like Luther. He's a Protestant only in the civil sense of, I don't want Rome running my business anymore. I'm going to run things from here. Now, this is what happens. King Henry VIII becomes a Protestant overnight. He doesn't believe anything like Luther. He doesn't agree with Luther. He thinks all Protestants are heretics, including William Tyndale and William Wycliffe and John Wycliffe. All these people, he had several of them burned. He burned John Frith, a good friend of Tyndale's, burned him at the stake. So we're talking about a man who is not a Protestant, but he becomes a Protestant, and he's on the Protestant side, and he takes sides with the Protestants, and he defends Protestants, even though he's not a Protestant. Now you can see how this can get very, very complex, and who your friends are, whatever. Well, he finally divorces Catherine and marries Anne Boleyn. Actually, he got her pregnant before he got married to her. So anyway, they have Henry the Sixth. So Henry the Sixth is an heir, a male heir. Whoa, wonderful! And of course, he had five other wives after that. So because he became the king, and he can do what he wants because now he's the head of the church and everything. He can just grant himself divorces and whatever. This is King Henry the Eighth. He's not a good guy. This is not a good guy. This is a Protestant, a political Protestant movement. Then you have the political Catholic movement. They don't care about doctrine. They just think, you know, we want this power base, whatever. Then you have the actual Protestants that are anti-Catholic in doctrine. They're the Wycliffeites. They're the Lollards. They're the... And out of those, you have some of them joining the political faction of the Protestants. And so then you have like probably 10 or 15 different major groups within English Christianity causing this Reformation. King Edward was a modern-day Josiah. He was a child king. I think he was 6-7 years old when he first reigned, and he reigned 6 years, whatever. He died when he was 13. He was Protestant. Now, you think, how can this little 6-year-old kid be Protestant? How do we know? Well, it all had to do with their regents, the people who were on their side, their party. All of these people had a party, and these were noblemen that had taken their side, and they made a party. It's like we have Republicans and Democrats. They had made these parties, and so these regents were strong Protestants, the ones of Edward VI. Strong Protestants. Well, he had a sister named Mary, who was strong Catholic. So you have this political... But now Edward wasn't a political Protestant. He was a decided believing Protestant. So we have King Henry VIII, who was a political Protestant, and you had Edward VI, who was a believing Protestant. He really reformed. He wrote, let me see, what did I say on here? He wrote, Edward was crowned. He imposes Protestant rights. I forget what the thing is called. Act of Uniformity. He writes the Act of Uniformity, which forces all the churches in England to follow the Protestant rites and teach the Protestant doctrines and whatever. Well, he dies. And when he dies, exactly what King Henry VIII was trying to avoid happens. You have this fight for succession. Jane Seymour and Queen Mary, Mary wasn't queen at the time, and they had all been declared illegitimate children because King Henry VIII kept on getting divorced and getting a new wife, and so all of his children from earlier wives had to be declared illegitimate, or his new wife wouldn't like him very much, or whatever. So anyway, they have all these crazy laws going on about who is, they have this argument and fight, it's just a horrible thing. Finally, Jane Seymour is beheaded, and Queen Mary gets in power, and the Catholics take over. This is the one they call Bloody Mary. She started killing people. First person she killed, the Archbishop of Canterbury, a guy named Cranmer. Strong Protestant. All of Edward's nobility, all beheaded, burnt at the stake, whatever. They just started dying right and left. This was the time of the Marian exiles. This is the time of the famous, the Marian exiles, people like John Fox and John Knox. These people, they had to flee for their lives. So they go to the mainland Most of them go to Holland, some of them go to Switzerland, Geneva, or France. They all go over there, and they start their own parties over there, waiting for the opportunity to go back. I forget how long Mary lasted, like 8 years, 10 years, whatever.
Five.
Really? Okay. Queen Mary's crown, 1553, 58, you're right, she only lasted 5 years.
Yeah.
Well, it was bad. This was a bad 5 years. A whole bunch of people got killed. And the Marian exile. This is an important time in English Reformation history because all of these Marian exiles, all of these people who were being persecuted by the Catholic Party, they were all Protestants of different parties. Well, they all are forced to go over to Holland or France or whatever, and they all know each other over there. And they all hash it all out. They argue it out. And they meet all the Jews. The Jews were expelled from England by the kings even before the Protestant Reformation on it. And so all these Jews are over there. And these are people, they're just hashing everything out, knowing each other, they all know each other, and they come back a whole lot more united. They start calling themselves Puritans. And Puritan was a whole lot of different factions. They were dissenters, they were separatists, they were nonconformists, they were all these different groups, including Baptists and Congregationalists and fascinating how all of these people get together. They know each other. They also studied under a guy named John Calvin. Now, Calvin is a Calvinist, you know, the predestination, all that stuff, whatever. But that's not what he was really known for. What he was really known for was he understood the Bible. He read the Bible, and he had reasonable, understandable explanations of how this applies. And you read his Christian Institutes, and it makes what you and I understand now is just normal doctrine. This was the first time anybody had ever explained it. And he clarified everything and unified everybody under his Calvinistic scheme. Now, later on, Calvinism became associated only with the predestination side of it. And that was bad. It was way overstated, overblown. But the truth is, the Calvinist conception of Scripture was against Lutheranism, because Lutheranism was basically Catholic with a few doctrinal changes. It was against Anglicanism, because that was Catholic with almost no doctrinal changes. Because Anglicanism, remember, Anglicanism was King Henry VIII's political, we're separated from Rome, and all these people, they're still doing exactly the same thing, they're still Catholics. But they're now Anglicans. Well, and then, of course, that got messed up because then the Anglicans had all these actual Protestants joined up with them. And so you had every range of different belief among the Anglicans. And all of these people were put into power. So you have real Protestants put into high positions of power in England. Not anywhere else, but in England, they have these power bases being filled by people who knew the Scriptures and had been taught by John Calvin. Basically, you had a government that was maybe a third very, very strong Bible-believing government. Well, what happened over the years is that these Puritan groups, when Mary was finally deposed and Queen Elizabeth came in, she became a decided Protestant leader, but she wrote, she did the Religious Act, what it's called? The Religious Settlement. She did the Religious Settlement to calm down the Catholics. Said, look, because the Catholics killed so many high-ranking Protestants. And then when Elizabeth took over, they wound up killing Thomas More and some high-ranking Catholics. She said, look, this has got to stop. So Elizabeth said, look, let's make a settlement. So they made some compromises on both sides and settled it down. You're looking at probably 80% of the population was very much in favor. But then you had this 20% of the population that thought that was all demonic, devilish. This Puritan movement just started growing, huge growing. And not only growing in numbers and in reasonable men, really great minds, working things out, how things had to be done, what was important, what was not, how the Bible should be understood, searching back into history, teaching like John Fox, giving us all these books of martyrs. So much was learned during these days because all the higher, Oxford was run by Puritans. Cambridge was run by Puritans. All of the Matthew Parker was an Anglican, but he was a Puritan. He was working for the king, which was the Protestant political party, but he was a Puritan. And Reynolds was a Puritan. You had so many Puritans. And then, of course, the Puritans were divided into several different layers also. You had Puritans who were high church Puritans. They believed in the Puritan doctrines, but they believed also in the high church functions. Then you had the low church Anglican Puritans, which believed in a pure church and did not believe in the high church functions. Then you had what they called the separatists, or the independents, or the Brownists. They had all different names for them. These were the people that had to separate from the King of England. They were called Puritans also. They were all part of the Puritan faction. The Puritans started gaining power. They were very powerful in numbers. Then they made a Bible back in 1560, and it went through many different successions, and all these very important men put in their comments in the Bible and made it very understandable, and very basically started denying the divine right of kings, causing the kings to outlaw these Puritans. So, man, what a tumbled mess we had here. But this is a whole different beast than the mainland Protestants. These are not Lutherans. This is an entire nation having convulsions, trying to come to some consensus, and they were forced to because of the way things happened. So Queen Elizabeth was a Protestant, and she defended Protestants, but she wasn't a Protestant. She didn't really believe the Bible. She had people burned at the stake. You know, she was King Henry VIII. Only Edward VI was truly a Protestant. King Charles after King James. King James was not really a Protestant. He was one of these political Protestants. They just, how do you explain it? It's just an amazing fact that God had the Protestant religion come to the very pinnacle of power exactly at the moment. And then think about it, the Spanish Armada was defeated in 1588 by Queen Elizabeth's army. And it was basically defeated by God because of all the contrary winds and everything went bad for them, and gave this Protestant nation the only superpower status in the entire ocean, all over the world. Owned the world, basically. Owned the seas by 1588. So we go from Wycliffe and a few underground Lollards being persecuted. And then within 200 years, that was like in 1380, and by 1580, God has made the most powerful nation on earth a Protestant nation. And from then on, from that point on, about 300 years, ruled the whole earth. Fantastic, amazing. Out of these Brownists that were burned at the stake by Elizabeth, No. When did that? No, that was by King Charles or King James. They had to flee to Holland. They were just going broke in Holland. They didn't know what to do, and they decided let's go to America, and they go to America and create the oldest continuous settlement in America, Plymouth Rock settlement. The Puritans created New England. This was all out of the same huge movement. There's so many other areas that we could talk about. The Treaty of Edinburgh had to do with the English Reformation up in Scotland. John Knox comes back as a Marian exile. He comes back after Queen Mary was deposed. He comes back. Queen Elizabeth can't stand him because he wrote that one tract called The Monstrous Rule of Women. He was writing against Queen Mary, the Bloody Mary, and Queen Mary, Queen of Scots in the north, who were killing people. And he came to the conclusion biblically that women should not be ruling ever. And he wrote a tract about it. And so when finally Elizabeth takes over, he goes back to England. She says, She runs him out because he wrote against the rule of women. And he apologized and all that, but she wouldn't accept it. She never made peace with him from then on. All right. Oh, there's just so much here. Good grief.
So in 1611, the Authorized Version was printed.
That was by the Scottish King James. Yep. Let me see. You get into later on, you get into the First English Civil War, which is when these Puritans became so powerful, they completely dominated Parliament. All of the major army officers were talking about huge, big army officers, were Puritans. And basically they defeated King Charles, which is the son of King James, defeated him, but he wouldn't give in. They wanted to make a constitutional monarchy. They wanted to write a constitution and the king would be a king, but under these laws. And he refused. He was just a very proud king. He refused. He went out, raised money and raised an army from some King Aragon or whatever over there in the mainland, and crossed over and made another attack on them, and they captured him. They defeated him and captured him and executed him, which sent shockwaves all over Europe. Because here these Protestants had executed their king. They called him the regicide. They lasted about 20 years. They call that the interregnum, or the years of the Commonwealth. Oliver Cromwell was one of those huge generals, and Lord Fairfax, and these great minds. And they had invented gunpowder, of course, and they had real weapons. And by this time, they were inventing all of these amazing... Another thing you could study on, if you want to study on English Reformation history, is what's called the Royal Society. All of these Puritans were scientific geniuses. They were medicinal geniuses. They were figuring things out. Joseph Priestley, Puritan, part of the founding part of the Royal Society, discovers oxygen, discovers, you know, they used to think it was phlogiston. You know, they had all kinds of mistaken understanding. They would weigh the air and prove that. These were scientists of the first order. They created the scientific revolution. These Puritans did. Created the Royal Society. But remember, Puritans had several factions. And the Puritans that lasted were the Puritans that stayed on the side of the king, on the side of the one that was in power. And they're the ones that lasted and went forward. One interesting note is how it finally winds up was John Bunyan. You notice that in, let me see, where is it? Okay, in 1658, this was during, 1658 was during the Commonwealth, the rule of the Puritans. There was no king. Oliver Cromwell was ruling. But they still had all these laws. And one of the laws was you can't preach without a license. Well, John Bunyan, he was not a Puritan of the ruling party. He was what they called an independent. And he was preaching out in the streets. And they finally arrested him and said, you can't do that. Well, they let him go. They were a lot nicer to him than the king was. Later on, when Charles II comes back, the son of Charles I that was killed, the son comes back, Charles II, and they turn the kingdom back over to him. They make an agreement with him to give him back the monarchy because Cromwell had died. And well, that's fine. That's no problem, except he starts making all these, what they call the Clarendon rules, or I forget what they're called. But they're like five or six.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they? Clarendon Code?
The Corporation Act.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there they are. The Corporation Act, the Great Ejection, the Conventual Act, the 5 Mile Act. All of these were designed to stop anybody from preaching that wasn't a member of the Anglican Church. Well, look at those acts. The 5 Mile Act. It forbidden any nonconformist minister from coming within 5 miles of any town.
Wow. You
couldn't be within 5 miles of any town. If they showed up within 5 miles of any town, they were arrested.
Like
you can see how this was very, very...
The conventicle?
And of course, John Bunyan was in prison for 6 years before they passed these laws, and then they finally decided to let him out. He lasted a few weeks out, and he's preaching again. They caught him again, arrested him. He spent another 6 years. He spent a total of 12 years in Bedford County Jail. But in 1672 was the Declaration of Religious Indulgence. John Bunyan was released. He received one of the first licenses to preach under it. They released him and gave him a license to preach. They said, we give up. This was finally. Then, of course, James II was crowned, and he was the last Roman Catholic king of England. He was the son of Charles II, and so James II was a Catholic. He actually belonged to the Catholic Party, and there were still a bunch of Catholics in England at the time, but they were suppressed. Well, he's tried to do some things, and it made everybody mad, and so they deposed him. And they had what they call the Glorious Revolution. He was overthrown, and that's when they wrote the English Bill of Rights, which granted freedom of conscience and religious liberty to all Catholics and to everybody, even the Catholics. Catholics could believe whatever they wanted. That's how the Reformation made it from Wycliffe all the way to the English Bill of Rights, 1689.
Wow. That's a lot of history in there.
What's Queen Elizabeth now?
What do you mean, what is she now?
Is she Catholic or Protestant?
Oh, this,
the English.
No, I mean, what now?
The Glorious Revolution here made a rule after James II made a Catholic. They made a rule, no English sovereign can be a Catholic.
Oh, really?
All English sovereigns, if someone's a Catholic, you'd have to abdicate. She would have to abdicate. Now, they might have changed that law in the last 20 years or something. They might have. They've actually done a lot of changing of laws in England in the last 20, 30 years. They've repealed some of these religious acts. In the last 20, 30 years, they've repealed them and tried to, you know, bring their laws up to date. So they might have actually repealed that. But in 1689, they made a rule that no English sovereign could ever be a Catholic again. Because Queen Mary, and then again they got this James II that started it up again, and they said, look, no more, we're not going to have any Catholics trying to force our nation to be Catholic. Because what happens is if they become Catholic, they give the Pope power. And they're not going to let, this is English Reformation, they are anti-Rome in their blood. From long before the Reformation, they are anti-Rome. And so they're not going to let Rome have the power. That was their idea. So, no, she's Protestant.
They just look so Catholic. You know, you've seen some of the weddings on TV.
Remember, they're Catholic. These are Catholic in everything but the name.
Okay.
Remember, this is a Protestant Catholicism.
But they, can the Anglicans, can those marry?
Oh, yeah. There's some differences. There are some differences, but in their way of thinking, in their church liturgy and everything, these are Catholic. Compared to what we consider evangelical Christians, we look at them, they're just so Catholic. They have priests and they have, you know, archbishops and they have cardinals and they have all this stuff, you know. And
kind of like Episcopals over here, kind of.
Episcopalians here are Anglicans there. When the Americans split from England in 1776, they didn't want to call themselves the Church of England anymore, so they changed their name to Episcopalian, which means ruled by bishops. Episcopalian is a form of church government. Presbyterian is a form of church government. Congregationalist is a form of church government. And Episcopalian means they're ruled by bishops. The hierarchical system, top down, but bishops are appointed by their higher ups. The Presbyterian system is that they are either they're elected and can never be fired. But the Presbyterian system has the rule by elders, and it's a little bit different. It's not even like ours. Congregational is what came out of the Puritans, and that was democratic. The body of believers voted on their bishop. And of course, we are Plymouth Brethren type. We believe in multiple elders raised up in the congregation and recognized by their labor, by their work. So these are different types of church government. Episcopalian just means they're top-down. Lutherans are that way too. Synods and you know, decisions made by higher-ups as to who gets what position in what church. And
this church just split. They split with the Lutherans because they were allowing gays to preach.
Lutherans were?
Wasn't it?
That's surprising. Now, I know the Methodists.
Well, that's
true,
but I think it's the Lutherans.
We just read it.
Oh, that's
terrible. I want to say that was like a year or so ago.
Yeah, it was.
The Missouri Synod?
Split. They had a big split because some of them up north was allowing gays and gay pastors and women, gay pastors.
Didn't quit going to a Lutheran church because of that?
Yeah. Wasn't it gotten different? Years ago.
It was them. They did mention that.
Yeah. I read that.
What are the Methodist beliefs today? Don't they baptize babies?
Depends on which Methodist. But yes, Methodists will accept baptism of babies. So will Presbyterians and Lutherans and Anglicans and Episcopalians. They all baptize babies.
How about as far as salvation? What do they?
Depends on the Methodist. You've got conservative Methodists. Now, the United Methodists, they're as liberal as, there's no denomination more liberal. None. Catholics are good Bible-believing Christians compared to United Methodists.
Really?
United Methodists.
Yeah. But you've got other groups of Methodists. Like, there were some Methodists in Mexico who were, they were straight on the Bible as we are. They're just solid. And there are some Presbyterians in Mexico that are solid. solid believers.
Isn't it amazing that they got such differences amongst even the same group?
In any group, you might have some really good Christians. Like you go to the United Methodist, you might find a circle of really good, committed Christians among them. You really can't judge the whole group by their leadership.
Did you read that book, and you probably have The Reason for God, and I Hate to Get This Book on You?
No, I haven't read that.
The guy that wrote it, Timothy Keller, he has, I think, a huge church, a Presbyterian church in Manhattan. Joe Webb had recommended that book when Roth went through his disbelief, and after a while, finally, he actually had the book, and he hadn't read it yet. So the one Joe got, he gave to us, and finally read it. It was kind of hard to read right at first because the guy, well, he's a very intelligent, well-read guy, but he kind of read it first. It's kind of like he feels like he's arguing with you already about it, but that's the kind of people he deals with all the time. So I mean, it feels like it starts out like that, especially because...
What's the name of it?
The Reason for God in an Age of Skepticism.
I read one that I gave to Ross. He's not a Methodist, I think. He thinks he's a Presbyterian.
It's a white book.
And his name is Gregory Boyd. Gregory Boyd. Excellent, excellent defense of theism, you know, to believe in God. Yes, it was
well,
excellent.
Well, Ross finally read this book when he was in Iraq, The Reason for God. And he was already coming around.
Yeah.
He had really lost his joy, so there was nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
But it made, he thought, he called it an awesome book. It made a big difference for me. So I actually don't have mine right now. I gave it to,
The Reason for God.
Yeah.
Do I have your book?
No, you gave it to me. I was going to read it again, but I talked to Bernie Newman the other night. She was telling me about Scott. So I gave her that one. I said, I enjoyed reading it. And it made a big difference for Rob. And then the one that, I gave her the other one that, Bernie
has
suggested was Mere Christianity.
I don't like C.S. Lewis. I mean, I like his writing and all that, but I don't think he is very persuasive.
Read that one, but this other one was, I mean, that seems like this, I mean, this guy, this church is in Manhattan. So intelligent, skeptical people, and so he gives you some of the conversations.
Yeah, I would like to read that.
Oh, sure.
I'll get it. I'll have it in my office by Tuesday.
He might not be as skeptical after the Hurricane Sandy hit.
I mean, that's what his whole thing
is. It makes a difference in people's minds. Yeah. They start having needs.
God sent Hurricane Sandy in order to get Obama elected again.
It's possible.
Yeah, and that's what Harry Reid and a few others.
God is doing whatever he wants to do, I can tell you that.
News guy.
Ooh. Uh-huh. Whoa. I don't think this is good for me.
You enjoy it. You
have
the peanut butter with it?
I didn't know
you liked it. I love cherry pie. I just never get it made for me.
What?
Oh. 26
years and I don't know.
26
years and I don't know that you like cherry pie. I would have lost that one on the
What was the name of that book we read? Lee Strobel? What was the name?
The Case for Christ.
Yeah, The Case for Christ.
He's good.
I like that book. That was a good book.
He's very good.
Yeah, he was. I watched the documentary even on TV.
Well, when I went to school at Wayland, I took all of the religious type of religion, and that's why I learned him. But they haven't read a lot of those books.
We were in one of the Christian bookstores, and they had a whole stack of them, and they were up at the register, and they were like $1 a piece. And we bought a bunch of them, yeah, and passed them out.
Debbie, this is not good.
You wouldn't like it at all.
It's pretty bad.
When I get through this, I'll eat your food.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Just to save you.
Can't you eat like sugar-free ones?
Do much of the whatever that weird stuff
that they
have sugar-free stuff
in my...
Unless someone goes out of their way
and
completely makes something like that for me, I'll eat it. But,
I don't eat it. It triggers just as if it
puts
sugar almost, right, in your body?
I'm not sure. I think sometimes they say your body doesn't know what to do with it. Because actually they say people that do that all the time, they're actually gaining weight.
That's my weakness.
I asked my doctor the other morning, yesterday morning, I went to the doctor, I had my appointment. And I asked him, I said, what about those?